House Committee on Elections will come to order. Welcome, members. We have a full agenda today that may, in fact, spill over to Thursday, so I think we should start pretty soon. I think Vice Chair Halverson will take the gavel because my bill is up first.
Thank you. The first up on the agenda, we don't have a quorum yet, so we can't move the bill, but we can start the discussion on House File 2096. Representative Simon, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thanks for your indulgence here. As you remember, members, we had an interim hearing on this in late January. This is the online voter registration bill, House File 2096. And I'll spare you the recitation of why I think this is needed and why I think this is the right timing, except to say that I think there's widespread agreement across party lines, across geographic lines, that this is a good thing to try to do, that in an era when we do so much else online, both in the private sector, when it comes to buying all manner of gifts and products and services online, and even in the public sector, where we can register our license tabs and obtain other government services or licenses online, this is a direction that we should be headed. As I said in the late January hearing, I just want to get the sort of big issue out there, sort of the elephant in the room, is there has been and is a dispute over whether the Secretary of State has or had authority to go forward and implement this in the way that it did. We're not here to resolve that. That's going to be resolved, if at all, in a pending judicial proceeding in Ramsey County right now. So we're focused here on the substance, and I think we had an extraordinarily productive hearing in January. And then since then, I should back up, members. At the time, you may recall, for those of you who were there, at the January hearing, we heard testimony about some constructive criticism and suggestions from a number of testifiers. Mr. McGrath, who I see is here from Minnesota Majority, I think had some very constructive suggestions about how to make the bill better, more secure, make it a bill that would inspire more confidence in more people. And to that end, members, and I know we don't have a quorum, but if you look at the DE1 amendment, we decided after an interim, we do have a quorum. Okay. Madam Chair, I'll move that House File 2096 be re-referred to the General Register, and then I'll move adoption of the DE1 amendment just to get the bill in the shape that I'd prefer.
Very good. Representative Simon moves the DE1 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? It passes.
Thank you. Madam Chair, to the DE1 amendment, and thanks, members, for just getting it in shape. What I'd like to do, and I guess to some extent I'm preempting what might be later testimony here on this from Mr. McGrath or others, but Mr. McGrath, I think, helpfully provided us at the interim hearing and then since with a list of more or less six areas that he thought would benefit the bill, that would make it a better bill. And I'm pleased to report that the DE amendments include substantially all of those suggestions. There was a meeting that we had in the between the interim hearing and today. Mr. McGrath was there, Representative Sanders, Mr. Marble, and some others were there, where we tried to hash out what I think now is largely a consensus view. So I'm going down a list here. This is not a committee handout, but a list of Mr. McGrath and others' suggestions for improvement. And then I'll show you where they're incorporated in the DE1 amendment. So the first one, and I'm not going to read verbatim, but basically the first one was that although the bill requires a verifiable state ID or driver's license number, there's nothing in the bill that explicitly says that the Secretary of State's office or anyone else has to verify that data. I think that's a fair point. So we've done that, and that language is at several places in the bill. I just draw your attention to line 1.23 as the first example that I was able to discover of a number of examples where that same cookie-cutter language is used that explicitly requires verification. And to be fair to the Secretary of State's office, they've said that this is their policy anyway, but this just codifies that policy. And I think there's agreement on that language. The second point that some raised in terms of constructive criticism was to make sure that if there is suspicious activity, if there's a mismatch, and a repeated mismatch even, between information that a prospective voter submits and what is on file for that person, whatever the number may be, that has to be referred for investigation to law enforcement. So you'll see several instances in the DE-1 amendment. The first that I discovered was line 2.3 or thereabouts, where you'll see that language. It recurs more than once in the DE-1 amendment for different contexts, but that's an example where I think we've met the charge there. The third of the constructive criticisms or suggestions was that the bill should require the Secretary of State to monitor and log IP addresses. That way, anyone, either from the public or the Secretary of State's office itself, can monitor if there's any suspicious activity, a lot of registrations, for example, an inordinate amount coming from the same IP address or a particular cluster of addresses. I thought, and we all thought, that that too was a constructive change, and you'll see that, for example, on line 2.10. There's an example of that language that appears as well. I do want to say, in the interest of full disclosure, there was one subpoint to that third recommendation that we did not come to consensus on. There was a suggestion that we perhaps ban the use of foreign servers, but that was deemed, I think, generally by the group that met to be a little problematic. We checked with the Department of Military Affairs, and although it's true that overseas personnel at military bases and at embassies would show a U.S. IP address, the problem is that we have military personnel who either live off base or are stationed at other nations' military installations. That's fairly typical and fairly common. And in that instance, those American citizens, those Minnesota residents, would not be able to avail themselves of a U.S. IP address, and we didn't really want to go there. So, full disclosure, that's one of the suggestions that was not adopted here. I think the only one. The next suggestion that was brought forward in the hearing and then afterwards in our meetings was that the bill should require the online application system to monitor for suspicious activity, like the multiple submissions that I just talked about, or a high volume or rate of submissions, and that law enforcement should be required to investigate. That, too, again, appears on line 2.10, same kind of language. The next one, which I thought was a really interesting just legal issue, was this idea of clarity on the jurisdiction or jurisdictions that would have the right to pursue criminal charges. Is it the jurisdiction where the fraudster, let's say, resides, or the jurisdiction where that person intends to register, if different from where that person resides? And we decided to resolve that issue, you'll see, to everyone's satisfaction, as far as I know, on line 5.16. And so that there's that jurisdictional language there that clarifies what would happen in the case of suspected suspicious activity and who has jurisdiction. So it maintains, and I would argue expands, the flexibility there. So I thought that was a very fair and good point. And then lastly, in terms of the list of potential constructive criticisms, was one that we also adopted, which is require a standardized voter registration document for each online registration. In other words, if I can characterize the concern there, it was that we don't just want random data in some area that's stored. We want something that, if someone were to request it, is printable in a format that is much like or identical to the paper copy, so that if someone made a request to see, 10 certain applications, they could find those and they could be printed out in a way that's substantially similar. And we did incorporate that. If you look at line 4.32, that standardization is incorporated there as well. So the sum and substance of this, member, is, other than the one sort of sub area that I mentioned, which is the ban on foreign IP servers, which the group, I wouldn't say unanimously, but the consensus was we thought that was going maybe a bridge too far. Other than that, my assessment of it is that we adopted all of the other constructive criticisms or suggestions that were proposed at the interim hearing and then in the meeting that we had before. So that is the DE-1 amendment. I hope at this point that we are at a point of consensus where, we might not have attained perfection, but we've attained a bill that I think people can agree on that has the security and sort of anti-fraud safeguards and provisions in it, and yet goes forward with a technology that is accessible, that is apparently popular, and that I think would provide a lot of convenience to a lot of voters. So with that, I'm open to any questions, members. Thanks for your time and attention.
Members don't have any. Okay. If members don't have any questions, I believe that there is an amendment that is going to be offered, the A6 amendment.
Right. I'll offer the A6 amendment, Madam Chair. And just, it's very technical. They're both technical. Line 1.3, neglected to put in person or by mail in terms of when something is received. I think we'd all agree to that. And line 1.4, this is language, that's right, or registration received electronically through the Secretary of State's secure website no later than 11:59 on the 21st day preceding any election. That's right. That had to do with, you know, my memory's failing me here. Maybe someone from the Secretary of State's office might. Thank you. Or Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, so this amendment is just clarifying that the current deadline for submitting paper applications, which is 5 p.m. on the 21st day before an election, still applies to those paper applications. But then if a person submits an electronic application through the website, they can submit it up until midnight the day of the deadline.
Thank you. Thank you, agree, Ms. Fraser. Okay. So that's it. It's very technical.
Okay. Is there any discussion to the A6 amendment? Then all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment passes. And I think didn't see any other questions to the DE1 amendment, so we could move on and hear from Ms. Frazier.
I think she's just here to answer.
Just answer questions?
Questions in terms of the technical feasibility.
We have others who are have signed up to testify. Judd Choate from... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong bill. I jumped ahead. I'm sorry. It might have a little something to do with this new revelation in my life that I need reading glasses. My apologies. I didn't mean to jump ahead. So if there's any additional discussion on the DE1 amendment to as amended to 2096.
I think, Madam Chair, I think we already, didn't we?
DE1
we adopted the DE1.
Yes. Oh, okay. Yep. A6 and A7. Okay. The bill as amended, 2096. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Simon, Chair Simon, for your work on this. I think that this is actually a really good piece of legislation for our state. I think that in addition to opening up access, it also opens up integrity in our election system. And helps move our entire election process in a more technological way, which I think is a really good thing for our state. I wish we could have started with this process. I think it's been very smooth, like I said, it's a good piece of policy for our state, so I'm happy to support it and encourage other members to as well.
Is there anybody who hasn't been heard on this bill from the audience who wishes to testify on House File 2096? Nope. Seeing none. Representative Simon renews his motion to for House File 2096 to be re-referred to the General Register. Is that clear? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And the motion passes. Thank you.
Okay, the next bill on the agenda, members, is House File 2265. Representative Lane, welcome to your bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 2265 be re-referred to, is it civil law?
Civil law.
To the Civil Law Committee.
Please proceed.
Okay, and I have a short amendment. The A1 amendment simply offers better wording in a few spots to make it clearer. So it's a very simple amendment, A1. I move that.
Okay, Representative Lane moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Representative Lane.
Thank you. Well, in 2012, a consortium of states, politically balanced with both Republican and Democrat secretaries of states, created an organization called the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC for short. The sole mission is to assist states to improve the accuracy of their voter records and to increase access to voter registration. We live in a very mobile nation. It takes a concerted effort among the states to actually make sure their voter rolls are accurate. So this bill before us would permit Minnesota to join this consortium in order to improve the integrity of our voter rolls and assist in voter outreach. We have with us today Judd Kowak?
Choate.
Judd Choate?
Choate.
Who is the chair of the ERIC and then the director of elections in the state of Colorado. And he's going to give us a presentation so that we can understand this better.
Hi, everybody. My name is Judd Choate. I'm the election director for the state of Colorado, and Colorado was one of the first seven states to join ERIC, which was formed in 2012. And I'm the chairman of the board of directors of ERIC, so I was very nicely invited to come and give a little talk for you guys to explain what ERIC is and how it works. Let me tell you a little bit about myself and my state. In Colorado, we were one of the first states to join ERIC. We are a state that is thought of to do very good in the administration of elections. In fact, in most of the various measurements that are done by independent groups about state administration of elections, Colorado scores in the top four. I don't really like Minnesota because they score in the top two. So I wonder why I'm here trying to help Minnesota. I should be staying home in Colorado, but I am happy to be here because I think that ERIC and the work that ERIC does is very important for the future of elections, and I think it would really help your state. So let me walk you through what ERIC does and some of the already important advancements we've made through only a year and a half of participating. The mission of ERIC is to assist states to improve the accuracy of their voting rolls, to reduce costs and improve efficiency for the state and local election officials. The way we do this is by exchanging data. Right now, states do a very inefficient job of exchanging data. It's not an unusual thing at all for two bordering states to not have any idea who are on each other's voting rolls, especially states that may have large population centers near the border. That was one of the things we were trying to address in Colorado, and I think a number of the other states, especially in the regional groupings that we have. You may remember that President Obama created a presidential commission to examine long lines, and one of the things, they came up with five different recommendations, and one of those recommendations was to join consortiums like ERIC. So here it describes the way in which ERIC would be beneficial to states that attempted to join, and most notably, points out that it's a great way to reduce the amount of polling place congestion and reduce the number of bad files on the voter registration file. So what exactly do we have as current problems in our state administrations of elections that can be improved by ERIC? First of all, Pew did an analysis of the voter rolls that exist across the country and found that they believe 1.8 million people across the country are listed on voter rolls who have who are deceased. If you figure that we have around 200 to 220 million people registered to vote, that means about one in every 100, 125 people that are registered to vote in the United States are deceased. Obviously, that would be a great thing to address. We also have 2.7 million voters who are registered in multiple states. This is a big deal in a state like ours, and I suspect it might be a big deal in a state like Minnesota. In Colorado, we have a lot of what we call snowbirds, people that have places that they come and stay or live at during the winter so that they can go skiing, and then they move back to their home state. Well, they may very well become registered in both of those states, maybe on purpose, maybe accidentally, maybe as a property owner in one state and then as a full registrant in another state. they can, on that occasion, then go ahead and vote twice in those jurisdictions. And this would be a way to identify people that are inappropriately registered in multiple states. We also, Pew also found that 12.7 million records are out of date at any given time. Again, going back to the fact that we have about 200 to 225 million people registered, that's a very high percentage of people's registrations that are out of date. And that 51 million Americans are eligible but currently not registered to vote. How do we address these? Well, we can better identify those voters who have died because we have, through Eric, access to the SSA death list, so the Social Security Administration death list. In Colorado, and I understand that this is also the problem in Minnesota, we couldn't use the SSA death list because it only had two criteria that would allow us to match them with a file already in our database. And we needed three. So by using ERIC, we can link information to that file that already exists in the SSA and allows us to pull that into our data file for the voter registration and identify a person and feel very confident about that identification so that we can delete them from our file. Those people registered across states are found and reconciled because I have the data from Utah, and I know that somebody has moved from Colorado to Utah, and I can identify that person. And in, I just need to reach out to them and ask them to cancel their registration in Colorado. And once I know that they're in another state, I can automatically cancel them. Or if it's uncertain, I can ask them to cancel their registration. We also know about all the people that are that have, you know, bad records. Again, we live in a very mobile world now, where people move on a pretty routine basis. This allows us to keep track of those people and have a better idea of where they live at a given time. And in your state, you can automatically make those changes. In Colorado, we can't automatically make those changes because we are covered by the MVRA. You are not covered by the MVRA. And then, of course, all those people who are not currently registered but could be registered. This is one of the great things about ERIC is that it identifies who those people are, and you can reach out and suggest to them that they could register. We did that in Colorado through a postcard that we sent, a very sort of ordinary little government postcard that we sent to those 765,000 people that we identified who could have been registered but weren't. By getting some of those people to register way ahead of an election, that meant that we had far fewer people that were registering right at the election. And in a state like Minnesota, where you have same-day registration, you would be pushing people away from registering at the day of the election to some time previous in the election cycle. The various attributes of ERIC is that it is completely state-run. It's not run by any outside organization. I am from the state of Colorado. I'm on the executive board. So are the election directors from Nevada and Maryland. The entire board of directors includes all nine of the participating jurisdictions, which in this case are eight states and the District of Columbia. It was incorporated in May of 2012. So now we have almost 2 years worth of data on it, and we have already shown pretty substantial results with the reduction in number and amount of dead wood on voter registration files, and then also the increase in registration and clarity with which we have information on the database. We have a membership agreement that everybody agrees to. We have two full-time employees. One person is a data programmer, a developer. And then we have an executive director who runs the operation. We do routine uploads and reports the way Colorado does this. Of course, again, this is pretty much governed by an individual state. You can make your own rules as to the way you want to use that data for the most part. The way Colorado does it is that every two months, we send our data to ERIC. ERIC does the match. They send us a report. We send that report to the counties. The counties do the work. It's very seamless. It's now completely automated. So when we get it, it automatically ships to a file, which goes to the county. The county does their processing, and it's very easy, very straightforward. There are really very few things for us or for the county to have any problems with. We also are actively recruiting other members. That's improves the efficiency of ERIC, because the more files we get, the more we can clean, the more out-of-state people that we know about, the more that ERIC works in our benefit. These are the members that are currently in ERIC. You can see that we have a pocket of western states, the five participants on the west, and then we have four jurisdictions on the right, which represent those eastern constituents, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, and the District of Columbia. You'll notice the big gap in the middle where Minnesota is located. While it's true that there's no partner states very near to Minnesota right now, I can very confidentially tell you into this microphone that there are a number of states that are interested in your region, and we're talking to a number of those states. So I think once somebody joins, a whole group of states will probably join, because that's where you get the benefit. The great benefit comes from having a partner state, having states that have common borders. What does an ERIC report look like? Well, an ERIC report looks like it captures basically five different criteria of people. It catches in-state movers. These are people that are moving within the state. It catches cross-state movers, those who are deceased. In-state duplicates. So this is something that you guys probably have less of than we do, but in Colorado this is a big deal, because if you registered same day, so we have same day registration like you do, but if you already had an existing file, we're going to register you right then. And if you already have an existing file, well, we got to merge those at a later date. So ERIC really helps us to identify who those second files are, that, so we can merge them. And then it, of course, gives you a report on the potentially eligible but unregistered voters. These are some numbers from the last set of reports that were run in February. You can see that just in that one series of reports that was sent to nine jurisdictions, we identified 1.3 million people who had moved in-state, who had an old file that needed to be updated. In only those nine states, for only one reporting period, we identified 1.3 million people. There were also 227,000 people that had moved across states, 47,000 who were deceased, and then 29,000-ish who were in-state duplicates. We're generating those kinds of reports on a continuous basis, and it allows us to go in and make those changes, or in our case, invite the elector to make that change for us. In your state, again, not an MVRA state, you can make those changes. And then the last thing that it reports us are the people who are currently unregistered but are eligible. In this last report, that was 6.1 million people. We have only reached out to our eligible but unregistered population once. We saw about a 10% response rate. So we got a lot of new registrants out of that mailing. And that's all I wanted to tell you. Feel free to ask me any questions you might have. Thank you for your attention, and if I can do anything more to assist you with your legislation, please let me know.
Dr. Choate, is doctor?
Yeah.
Okay.
Dr. Choate.
Dr. Choate,
although nobody
thanks.
Calls me that.
Oh, all right. Well,
just say, hey, you.
Okay. You answer to that as well.
I answer to that.
Dr. Choate, I just want to clarify something, too, that these states have a mix of Democratic and Republican secretaries of state.
Yes.
There's no partisan divide here. In your state, for example, in Colorado, a Republican is secretary of state. We have a letter from him here, Mr. Gessler,
yes,
in the packet. I just want to make sure.
That's right. And actually, I can clarify that. We have our current makeup is eight states and one jurisdiction. So the District of Columbia obviously doesn't have a secretary. Of the other eight states, four of them have Republican secretaries, four of them have Democratic secretaries. My particular secretary is a conservative Republican, and I think he would underline conservative if I were to write that down for him. So it's you know, a big deal for him. He sees this as a great opportunity to clean his lists. For other states that prioritize the registration part, that's a very attractive thing for secretaries that are on the other side of the fence.
Members, any questions, comments? Concerns? Okay. Seeing none, I know this has other committee stops. Representative Lane, any parting thoughts? Or
I think he did a great job. Oh, thank you. I renew my motion that there's something.
I think we do have a couple.
Okay.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I'm sure you're prepared for this question, so hopefully it'll be an easy answer for you. Can you explain why we have blank appropriations under the third section and what you anticipate those to be?
Ms. Lane.
Yes, and that's your question.
We'll have Beth Fraser from the Secretary of State's office make a comment on that one.
Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser, Deputy Secretary of State with the Office of the Secretary of State. The blank appropriations are waiting for the fiscal note to be filled in. There are basically two costs associated with this bill. One is the cost of dues to join ERIC, to join the consortium, and Mr. Choate can speak to those. The second cost is the cost of doing the mailing to the eligible but unregistered voters. And other than that, there are very few costs associated with the bill because it ties into systems that we've already built. So, for example, we already have technology in place to load a file and have counties mark voters as deceased if they're identified as deceased. This would give us the data for that file. We already use data from the National Change of Address information when people move either in-state or out-of-state. This will give us data to feed into a system that's already built. So the two costs are the dues and the cost of the mailing.
Yeah, and I can talk to you about what those costs are. So there is a $25,000 cost to enter ERIC, and it's basically the seed money for the efforts to, you know, get new states and do all the various things related to running a consortium like this. And then there are the ongoing costs, and each year those costs are based on the number of states that are in ERIC, because the overall costs are pretty flat. They don't really increase incrementally with the addition of a new state. So as the number of states increase, the cost for the overall group goes down. Our costs this year, Colorado's costs this year, were around $60,000. So, and since Minnesota has a population that's very close to Colorado's, I would anticipate that your costs would be very similar. We have about 5.1 million people. I believe you have about 5.5 million people. So that's, you're going to be very similar in your cost ratio. As to the mailing, so when the way we did our mailing was that ERIC identified 765,000 people who were potentially eligible and not registered. We then mailed 631,000 cards to them. Now, you'll wonder why that number is less than the 765,000. The reason why is because there were a number of occasions where there were more than one adult living at one address who were not registered. So that we just decided to send one card to an address where there were more than one adult that were not registered. The cost for those mailings, on average, for us, including the paper, the cardstock, the printing, and the mailing, including postage, cost us on average about 17 cents, a little bit more than 17 cents per mailing. So our 765,000 people we mailed to for about $110,000. Now, the good news about that was that that's a one-time expense. I never have to go back and invite those people to register again. I can if I want to, but I never have to go back and do that. Well, the way Colorado's doing it is that we now collect that new group of people who have not registered going forward, and we're going to, in the next 6 months, invite them to register again. It's not going to be 765,000 anymore. Now it's going to be 15,000. And so the ongoing cost is, you know, substantially less, because once you've hit them once under the agreement, you don't have to ask them to register again.
Representative Sanders, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess Representative Lane, once the fiscal note comes in or those costs are in, would you please share that with the committee?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just one more quick line of questioning. All of this sounds well and good. I think the concern I guess one of the things that should be addressed in this committee is the security of the data And how that's going to work, understanding that we are, in a sense, passing data back and forth amongst states. I don't know, Representative Lehner, Mr. Choate, if you could discuss, and I don't know if this language is maybe very similar to what was used in Colorado or not, how secure is this data, and how safe should we feel with this data moving back and forth across states?
So this is the data transfer is done by way of a two-way hash, which means that as the data enters ERIC, it's hashed, meaning that no one can read it. And then on the way out back to the state, so like I send my data, Colorado sends its data in, let's say Minnesota sends its data in, we're not going to tell you what's common about those two data sets. What we're going to tell you is that you've got somebody who's living in Minnesota that's also living in Colorado. Here is that person. But we're never going to share the data that was common across those two data sets. So there's nothing that's known in Minnesota that's about the Colorado data, and there's nothing known in Colorado that's about the Minnesota data. All we know is that there's something common. All we know is what is the issue that's related to that particular voter. We don't know how that issue came about. ERIC doesn't let us know that. And ERIC, by the way, is housed in a very secure, ultra-secure data warehouse in Wisconsin. And it's in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it's a data warehouse that has some of the most important and secure data in the country. And we're just like one little server in this gigantic facility that, you know, covers a square mile. But it's very secure. It's designed so that I never have to see your data and you never have to see my data. Because if you did, under Colorado law, that would be a violation of Colorado law.
Representative Sanders. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of other questions relative to data practices and the route for this bill, Mr. Chair. Just based on the last piece of testimony, are we going to have this in civil law because of that's all I needed? No, I was in before we talked about the path of the bill. Thank you.
Yes, for the record, I nodded, but yes. Any further member comments, questions, concerns, testimony? Is there anyone here from the public who wishes to be heard on this bill? Anyone from the public?
Representative Simon.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted a clarification.
Sir, why don't you come up to the table and identify yourself first for the record and then ask your question. Thank you.
Bob Auden. I'm representing the Libertarian Party of Minnesota. I just have a... I was reading through the bill here, and it mentioned something about incompetence, and I was wondering, what was meant by that? It says here the county auditor shall mail to the voter a notice stating the voter's name, address, precinct, and polling place, unless the voter's record is challenged due to a felony conviction, non-citizenship, name change, incompetence, or a court revocation of voting rights of the individual under guardianship.
Representative Lane, I've just been advised, Mr. Auden, thank you for the question. I've just been advised, I think you're reading current law. That's not a change to the law in this bill. I think you're reading from current law that's on the books right now.
Oh.
Yes, if it's not underlined, it's current. It's not changing.
Okay.
So it's a question you can answer later.
Well, the other thing was, when the data is shared between the states, I understood that we don't get data back from necessarily Colorado or whatever, but would it identify people who voted twice? You know, maybe say in Florida if they were a member, and then here.
Dr. Choate,
it currently doesn't. Obviously, if the state members at a future date want to go forward and try to figure that out, we could definitely try to do that. But currently, the data doesn't do that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Auden.
I guess if it did figure that out, then I'm guessing the person would be prosecuted for voting twice?
Mr. Auden, I would assume so, yes.
You know, I could speak to that. In Colorado, we prosecuted 10 people over the last two election cycles for voting in multiple states.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rodden. Anyone else from the public who wishes to be heard on this bill? Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add one thing. I think that part of the benefit of ERIC is looking at data between the states. But one of the things that's actually most beneficial is looking at both the voter registration data from Minnesota and the driver's license data from Minnesota. And one of the pieces of information that they'll give us is how many people in the driver's license database have updated their address on the driver's license record more recently than on the voter registration record. And what we know from same-day registration statistics is 70% of people who do same-day registration have updated their driver's license. And if we knew who they were and could reach out to them before Election Day, which ERIC would allow us to do, and say, hey, update your voter registration, we would significantly decrease the number of people that wait until Election Day, which would save voters time, shorten voter lines, as well as save local election officials a ton of time and money. And so I think there's the potential for real cost savings at the local level if this bill is passed.
Any further comment, question? Oh, yes, someone from the public. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Catherine Dorr. I'm a Minneapolis election judge and belong to several election nonprofits. My question is, and I don't know if this really applies, is in Minnesota we have the Safe at Home program to protect addresses of women who are such as victims of domestic violence and certain public officials. And I'm wondering if your data, if Colorado has a similar program, would the Safe at Home requirements apply to the ERIC system? And I'm not exactly sure how all that would interact, or if it would be a factor that would be have it built into the system if Minnesota joined it.
Dr. Cho.
So that's an excellent question and a hurdle we had to cross when we joined. We do have what we call the ACP program, which is the Adult Confidentiality Program, in which we have nearing 10,000 people now who, again, domestic violence, are under a restraining order or are protected by a restraining order, or are policemen, judges, DAs, people who potentially might be targeted. And by the way, we've had incidences in Colorado even pretty recently where people have been targeted because of their holding of public office. And so that group is a big group of people, and so we needed to figure out a way to protect that group when we sent it up into ERIC. The way that you can do that, one of two ways. Either you are protected by the fact that it's two-way hashed, so none of that information is going to go to another state anyway. But you can also protect that information before you ever send it, and that's the way we're choosing to do it. And that is, in our files, we identify all of those people as ACP. So instead of having a person's name, like let's say I was on that list, and so my file says Judd Choate, it would have ACP, and it would have my number. And so even if somehow that information got accessed by another state or by another jurisdiction, it would just see that it was ACP and have my number. It would still have all of the other criteria, though, and it would still allow me to do the match, but it would just not identify who I was. So we do address that.
Very good. Ms. Fraser?
Mr. Chair and members, in Minnesota, under the Safe at Home law, people who are in Safe at Home do not have active records in the statewide voter registration system, so their data would not be uploaded, would not be shared with ERIC to begin with.
Anyone else from the public who wishes to be heard on this bill? Any other final member comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, Representative Lane renews her motion that House File 2265 be re-referred to the 2265 as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lane. You are still up, Representative Lane. Your next bill, House File 2166 on electronic rosters.
I move that House File 2166 be re-referred to State Government Finance. And I would like to move a short amendment. The A1 amendment adds the date the evaluation of the study in the bill would be presented to the legislature.
Okay, Representative Lane moves an A1 amendment, a technical amendment. All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. To the bill as amended, Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, last year, the omnibus election bill created a task force to study electronic rosters. We wanted to examine the potential for the use of electronic poll books instead of our paper polling place roster. We also authorized a pilot project to examine 5 different types of electronic rosters in 5 different cities during the 2013 municipal elections. These cities could process same-day registration via electronic rosters or verify electronically the registration status of pre-registered voters or both. Well, the recommendation that's come out of the 15-member task force, and you have the list of people on that task force in your packet, and from the Secretary of State, from the information learned in this smaller pilot, is to authorize a study of the use of electronic rosters in a high turnout election of November 2014 and in more areas across the state. We would also test the ability to securely download pre-registered voter data and process data after the election. This bill also includes a formal evaluation of this study so that we can begin to focus in on what technology works best and a cost comparison as to the paper process that we do now. So the first article in the bill establishes the study with an appropriation to cover the costs. And the second article in the bill sets up the statutory requirements for the use of electronic rosters in Minnesota. We have some testifiers here. Beth, want to take the lead, or Joe? Okay.
Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser, Deputy Secretary of State. And we are happy to be here with the task force recommendations in bill form and to bring them forward. And the task force did a lot of work over the 9 months during the interim, had a lot of meetings and a lot of really great discussions. And I think that, you know, 2 members of this committee served on the task force, Representative O'Driscoll as well as Representative Lane. And, you know, doing another study of the poll books in a higher volume election, I think, makes a lot of sense. And the group is recommending doing some empirical analysis, as Representative Lane was discussing, to really study the amount of time it takes from beginning to end using the electronic rosters versus using the paper process, so that local jurisdictions in the state going forward can make a decision about the cost benefits of adopting this technology and whether it's a good use of public funds to do so. If the study is authorized, we fully expect that all of the technology, all of the programming for SVRS that's necessary will be available by the general election, so that it will be possible for counties to do same-day registrations and upload that data, as well as download pre-registered data and upload it after the election. That pre-registration upload and download was not available for the pilot this last year. And so that's one of another benefit of doing a pilot again this year in a larger election. And I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Any member questions, comments? Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fraser, could you talk a little bit about how expansive this pilot program will be, this new one?
Yes.
So where, yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sanders, so the second pilot, or the study, since some didn't want to do a pilot, it is now a study. The second study...
That sounds worse, by the way.
Mr. Chair, the participating jurisdictions are listed on 116 to 120. And so these precincts in Crow Wing County, Clay County, Dakota County, Blue Earth County, Hennepin County, and Ramsey County are ones that would participate in the study, where we would be working very closely with those jurisdictions to assess how the program, how the technology works. What this bill does not do is prohibit other jurisdictions from using the technology in 2014. There were some on the task force who wanted any jurisdiction who wanted to be able to use the technology. And so this says that these jurisdictions will be part of the study. Other jurisdictions may choose to move forward, but are not entitled to reimbursement of costs that local governments incur to use the technology in 2014, and would not be as closely monitored in terms of a report to the legislature on how it went. These jurisdictions would be included in a report to the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Sanders.
Okay, so then that I think that clarifies too on 4.20 and 2.1 that we are permitting jurisdictions to move forward if they so choose to use this technology. Correct, that's basically what you said. So we're going to do the study, but then we're also allowing them, you know, these counties, municipalities, school districts to use this if they so choose in any election. This technology.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sanders, yes, that is right.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, you have four blank appropriations in this bill. Could you walk us through why we have blank appropriations and what we expect those blank appropriations to be?
Fiscal note,
Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're waiting for the fiscal note to analyze what this will cost to support the different localities to do it and to support the study that we want to do a very clear study as to the actual costs of processing from beginning to end so that we actually know what the cost savings actually are.
Mr.
Fraser.
Chair and Representative Sanders, the fiscal note, the analysis has been completed and submitted to the MMB, and they are reviewing it before it's officially made public. But the analysis is for a total of $346,000 for these four costs in total. And so that includes the cost of reimbursing local governments who are participating in the study for their costs. That's about $90,000. It includes the cost of the empirical study of the time it takes to process records. I think that's about $150,000. It includes the cost of the build or buy analysis, which is one of the task force recommendations that Minute, in coordination with our office, work to or analyze whether it would make sense for the state to build its own software for electronic rosters into the future, or whether it makes sense instead to purchase this software that is available already on the market. The builder buy analysis is expected to cost about $90,000, I think. I'm sorry, $110,000. And I'm not sure I hit all four, but yeah. The total is about $346,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Fraser. I appreciate that. Mr. Chair, just maybe a troubling trend to have two bills in a row with blank appropriations. I know that obviously we're working on fiscal notes, but something I don't always like to see in bills as a finance committee is blank appropriations, but I know we're working on it, and we'll hopefully see those when they come out.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. And the next stop is the funding committee, state government finance, but that's a point well taken. Any other member? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the things that I think would be very helpful in this bill, and wanted to know if the group had talked about this in any way, is to be able to count the number of people that are voting on voting day. We didn't just talk about that, did we? You were smiling at me like, okay. And secondly, being able to scan student IDs and those types of things.
And
Representative Lane.
It is perfectly within the realm of reason for a area to scan, use voter student IDs as a thing to vote on. Ramsey County is considering doing that. It's part of the authorization.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, what I would say is that the bill sets minimum requirements that the vendors must meet in order for the technology to be used. And while some jurisdictions are interested in being able to scan student IDs, we would recommend against putting that in the legislation, because that meant if a vendor did not have the technology to scan student IDs, they would not be an option. And I don't know about the technology on different student IDs and if it might be able to scan some and not all. And instead, we believe it makes sense to say these are the minimum requirements. Of course, a jurisdiction could request that a vendor allow for additional functionality. In terms of the number of voters being counted, that was a heavily negotiated item in the task force recommendations, and I believe that there are a couple people here that want to testify about that item, but the task force ultimately recommended that that election judges, at least for now, not solely rely upon the count by the electronic roster, but instead continue to count either receipts or signed statements from the voter, and that based upon the technology, it's actually easier to do that counting. One of the things that we saw was that the rosters print out stickers that then can be placed on a piece of paper. And if you know that, for example, there are 10 stickers on each piece of paper, it's pretty quick to count the pieces of paper and say, okay, there are 12 sheets of paper, 10 stickers, we have 120 voters. And so it actually does speed up the counting process without relying upon just the technology to do the counting. But again, I believe there are two people here that want to testify about that issue.
And maybe this is a good time then to segue to our two testifiers who come here just for this bill. If they can just make their way to the table. And it doesn't matter to me which order, but if you just want to introduce yourself for the record, thanks for coming.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Max Halperin, a professor of computer science who served on the task force. And because the governor appointed me on the basis of my technical expertise, I feel maybe I ought to be the one to explain why it is we put such an emphasis on the use of paper. For example, as was just brought up, we recommend that no change be made in the means of determining the number of voters who signed in, that the election judges would still be physically counting signatures or pieces of paper. And that does seem odd, not only in terms of labor, but also in terms of accuracy. I'm aware that our election judges work very hard to count accurately and nonetheless have to count typically repeated times to make sure that they have a reliable count, whereas a computer system can provide the correct count the first try. So the question then, why do we consider the human count to be the authoritative one? And in brief, those of us on the task force who have the most close-up personal kind of relationship with technology all, I think, were of the opinion that we shouldn't trust it without verification. And electronic roster systems, unlike voting systems, are not subject to any kind of a certification testing process. And we really don't know anything about the development or quality assurance processes that the different vendors use. For all we know, there could be, you know, some glaring security vulnerability in any of these systems. Timely awareness of security vulnerabilities is not easy to come by. If you've been following the news, you've surely seen that Apple recently was put in the position of fixing just an absolutely gaping hole in their security that had been there for over a year. And I find it sobering to note that the systems affected by that include the iPad computers that were used in St. Paul and three precincts for the November pilot project. I emphasize, I'm not suggesting that that vulnerability was actually exploited during the November election, and in fact I am not aware of what other security precautions at other layers may have existed that would have prevented the exploitation of the underlying vulnerability in the iPad system, but it does bring to the surface the fact that it's very difficult to know and to have confidence in a black box kind of system whether it deserves the sort of public confidence that we have when humans count things in front of other humans' eyes. The election judges check the number of signed-in voters against the number of ballots in order to guard against innocent mistakes, things like inadvertently leaving some ballots in an auxiliary compartment. But it does also serve as an assurance that we're not seeing any ballot box stuffing, we're not seeing any theft of cast ballots. It's about public confidence. We don't really have a problem with ballots just spuriously appearing or disappearing. However, when a bitterly fought election is lost and feelings are running high, some may wonder whether such tampering could have occurred. And if you have those concerns currently, you can go at the close of the election and watch as the judges check the count. And it's not, in my opinion, equivalent to just trust a number that the computer gives you, because if you're imagining someone who might have tampered with the ballots, it's easy to imagine they could have tampered with the electronic roster system to provide the matching number. So it was the recommendation of the task force that we continue with the existing means of cross-checking that so that we can continue putting suspicions to rest rather than ramifying them. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions, members, or comments? Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Manske?
Mr. Chairman, again for the tape, I'm Joe Manske from the Ramsey County Election Office, and I have Christina Tweeten with me today, who is our team leader for the e-roster pilot or experimental use or whatever it was that we were calling what happened last year. And I'd like to have Ms. Tweeten just talk to you for a few minutes about what our experience was and why we do support the continued pilot project next year, because there are still some things that we would like to get clarified, and that we think this is the best opportunity to do that. And then afterwards, if I can just take 2 minutes of your time, I will talk about a few items in the bill, and I would be more than happy to talk to you about this this counting issue. So I'll have Ms. Tweeten start out here.
Ms. Tweeten, if you could just identify yourself for the record and spell your name, if you would.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Christina Tweeten. That's spelled T-V-E-D-T-E-N. And I'm an election administrator with Ramsey County. And I'm going to discuss the need for the pilot for 2014 and our experience from the pilot in 2013. The three issues that I'm going to discuss are additional program development needed for the electronic rosters, time to work with the vendors, and data security. Based from the pilot in 2013, Ramsey County isn't ready to implement a countywide e-roster solution. The processing and functionality need to be explored further. A more realistic time frame is needed to ensure that the e-rosters are successful. In 2013, vendors had 2 to 3 days to turn around the data that was provided for the e-rosters to ensure that they were functional for election day. The county needs the ability to upload, download, and audit the data that's being uploaded into the e-rosters. In 2013, the vendors did the upload because of the time frame, and an additional audit of the uploaded data wasn't performed. This is something that we're not comfortable with. We need to be able to audit the data. A development of procedures for testing and backup of the e-rosters. In 2013, we had backup units that were available and a support staff from the specific vendor available. The e-roster pilot in 2013 wasn't a true test of voter participation and how the e-rosters have the potential to function. It was a low turnout election. So we'd also like to test the registered and non-registered process of not having to do paper, and that would allow us, the pilot in 2014 would allow us to do that. And it's going to be a larger turnout election in 2014. And then for the 2014 e-roster pilot, Ramsey County would prefer to work with a single vendor and a smaller number of precincts, because then we'll have the ability to evaluate the functionality of the e-rosters. And then we also have less staff time available in 2014 to devote to this activity. Additionally, Ramsey County needs more time to work on e-roster issues that were identified in 2013. Some of the issues that need to be addressed are the e-rosters properly recording the proof of Election Day registration documentation and having it recorded on the voter registration application. In 2013, not all of this information was properly recorded, and when an upload was done into SVRS, the data was incomplete and had to be done manually. The e-roster needs to have the ability to scan and pre-populate onto the Election Day registration application using the acceptable documentations, including student identification cards. And then having one e-roster device that has the ability to process both registered and non-registered voters. This will allow for lines to move quickly and for all voters to be processed as they came into the polling location. And then the e-roster, it has to have the ability to capture an electronic signature that has the potential to be printed onto a voter certificate that is then given to the voter. This would eliminate the need for a wet signature on the voter certificate. And third, data security. A clear procedure on how to secure the e-rosters and the data stored in them. In 2013, the devices were in possession of Ramsey County, and the data wasn't uploaded until the Monday before the election, and then the devices were deployed to the polling locations. An outline of the conditions for access and use of the voter data in the polling place. In 2013, we had election judges that were participating in the pilot sign a data security form. And then standards on the physical security of the e-rosters on and before Election Day. In 2013, the e-rosters were in a secure area until deployment on the Monday before Election Day. And then on Election Day, e-rosters were returned to our office, and two vendors took the devices, and one of them had us ship the devices. These are just a few of the reasons for the 2014 electronic roster pilot to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tweeten.
And Mr. Chairman, just let me make a few points on the bill itself, and I appreciate Representative Lane's view, and I suppose this is Representative O'Driscoll's bill, that their obligation was to bring to you the recommendation of the task force. As I think you've heard, I think it would be useful, however, to have this, since this is a study, it's a pilot, it's a test. And one of the things that we want to be able to do is, not only do we want to gain some information for future administrative activities, but we want to be in a position to give you sound advice at the beginning of next year on what kind of a law that you want to enact for the long-term future. And as a result of that, I think we want to see, for example, capturing the signatures electronically. Right now, we give you this thing. What we'd like to do is to get rid of this and instead have a receipt printed out that has your name, your birth date, your address, and a copy of your signature. We would like to be able to scan more than just the state IDs. As Representative Bernardi mentioned, here in Ramsey County, we have 45,000 students who attend a county in Ramsey County, many of whom register on Election Day. Virtually all of them use their student ID cards. So the idea of being able to swipe or scan or photograph or however we harvest this data from student IDs is a big deal for us. We would like to be able to actively test that. And then finally, the counting of the number of people voting on Election Day in the polling place. Let me just remind you of something that you already know, but let me plow this field one more time. Our election judges get up at 4:30 in the morning. They report to work at 6 o'clock in the morning. They work until 8 o'clock at night. And then, after all of that, then we ask them to count these. I would suggest to you, based on our experience in 08 and 10, that the technology we use to count is hyper-accurate. Our demonstrated accuracy of counting ballots from the two statewide recounts is on the order of 99.98%. Not perfect, But for those of you who are familiar with Six Sigma, we are just at about Four Sigma. That is four standard deviations from the mean. That is pretty accurate. And I would suggest to you more accurate, and I would challenge any of you to join us, by the way, in years that you are not candidates. You come down and get up at 4:30 in the morning and start at 6 and eat the meager meals which are available to you. And then count these with 100% accuracy at the end of the day. So I think, again, this is a test. It's a pilot. Let us test this for you, and then we'll report back on how accurate. And I think it would be worthwhile, if we do that, it would be worthwhile to have our judges come back after the election, after the election day, but before the contest period. And we'll have them come back and count the paper documents after they've had an opportunity to sleep a little bit. But we would very much like to be able to do the electronic counting in the polling place and have a number at 8 o'clock at night, just as we do for the ballots. And then one last point here, that since I know that this is a part of the recommendations, I will tell you, speaking personally, as for those of you who don't know what my background is, having worked for the Secretary of State for 15 years, and joined with, if I can mention his name, Mr. Sigurdsson, who with me were part of the design team for both the original statewide voter registration system and the current one, that I would not underestimate the complexity and the difficulty of designing your own system. Not that you shouldn't do that, but it is a major operation. My recommendation to you is that we should buy and not build. The buy version is what we do with the voting systems, and that is we don't expect the Secretary of State or the state of Minnesota to develop a voting system. Our system, we let the counties make their own choices to get a system that meets their needs and to do so on an individual basis. And then the final point I would make there is that given the rapidly changing technology, remember, as the iPad, for example, I just checked this today, didn't even exist 4 years ago. 4 years from now, who knows what we're going to be using in a polling place or what we'll recommend to you for an e-roster. But my thought is that the buy option transfers the risk where it belongs to the private sector. They are set up to take risks and be rewarded for that. But we're not set up to do that. I don't think we want to take the kind of risk with your tax money of making a short-sighted or the wrong decision. So again, my personal recommendation to you based on our experience would be that we buy and not build an e-roster system. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Mansky. Any questions or comments from committee members? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I've been going over this bill, and there's a couple issues that we might need some clarification on before it goes to the next committee. One thing it requires in this is a report that's due on April 1st of next year. With the current makeup, with deadlines and stuff that'll probably be in place, it's going to be a little late in the legislative year to actually act on that report next year, unless it's at least a month earlier. But what makes that concerning is in the Section 2 of this, it has a effective date for other jurisdictions to start doing this and doing this process is after the January 1st of 2015. If there is a problem, we will not have time to fix it at that time. So I'm a little concerned about that. But the concept I do like. I think it's going to be the way of the future. It's going to be much easier for the election judges. I've actually understand what they go through. But I think we need to be careful before we go too far down the line in case there is a problem with the next study, that before we authorize it completely, that we get it done right to begin with.
Any comment? Mr. Mansky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I actually agree with you. And I don't know exactly what the mechanics are of getting the report back to you. My My personal preference would be, and again, I don't want to speak for Ms. Fraser. She is perfectly capable of speaking for herself. But my preference is that the report come to you earlier than later, and the reason being is that if we do want to start moving down this direction, beginning in 15-16, we would like to do something in 15, not wanting to use something brand new in a presidential election. Our preference would be to start rolling something out in 15 if this pans out. The earlier that we know what we're going to be able to do, the better. I think if we are left with the choice of starting in 16, I'm not sure that interests me all that much. I might defer that decision to 2017.
Go ahead, Representative.
Mr. Chair, while Beth is coming down, I can just say that the study has that date because we wanted to go very intensively into the understanding of what came out of the study, out of the work. However, we can, because of the authorization in the law, allow people to go ahead sooner than that. But it is a work in progress.
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, there are actually two studies that are due in April under this bill. One is the builder buy analysis that Mr. Mansky was just talking about. The other is the empirical evaluation of the time it takes to process records. And the builder buy analysis, the date was recommended by the task force based upon input from Minute and their assessment that it would take that long to do the builder buy analysis. You're right that Section 2, Article 2, does go into effect January 1st, and I think that of 2015. And my understanding was that the task force wanted to be sure that going forward there were some minimum standards in place, and so they took the minimum standards from this year's study and said these will be in place for the future. But with understanding that based upon what came out of the study, that the legislature might want to then modify them, but wanted to be sure there was some baseline, that there wasn't kind of a blank slate starting January 15 or after the study concluded. They didn't want there to be jurisdictions using poll books without any guidance or any minimum standards.
Any follow-up, Representative Johnson? Okay. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Representative Lane and Ms. Fraser, I noticed in the titling of the bill, we are in 1.5 directing the Secretary of State to adopt rules. I looked through this. I didn't see any overt designation to the rulemaking authority. What rulemaking is required of the Secretary of State for this bill? Is there any, and what would that consist of?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, I actually don't believe that there is rulemaking authority in this bill, and so it must be a drafting error.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Fraser.
Sanders.
And that may be then. I didn't see it in the bill, so maybe that might need to be addressed. Not sure if it does or not. And then my final comments on this, I would just say, Representative Lane, whatever you need to do to help facilitate the discussion with these other groups and these local governments, let's get this study done so that we don't have to come back and do another study, another pilot. We've had pilot projects. We've had a task force on this issue. We're having another pilot, another study, which is fine. This is something we definitely want to get right. But I don't want to study this thing to death. Let's figure out how we best can move forward and move forward quickly. And I agree it would be best to move forward with this in 2015 to be as optimal as possible in 2016. We've been talking about this for years. I think there's strong bipartisanship on wanting to move forward on this idea. But let's make sure whatever we need to study, let's study it in this study and not have to do another one. Let's get it right here. So whoever we need to talk to as a legislature, let's do that, so that we can implement this, which I believe will be very good for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. And that's a great point about the rulemaking. I'm glad you brought that up, because that would impact this bill procedurally in a short session. If it had explicit rulemaking authority, it would have to go, as so many bills do, to the state government, or I'm sorry, to the government operations committee. So, members, if you would indulge me here, I think from a technical standpoint, and Mr. Gehring, maybe you can help out here, I think it is best, since there is not explicit rulemaking authority in the bill, it's probably best that we just amend the title to reflect that. Ms. Fraser, is that, are you amenable to that?
Yes, Mr.
Okay. Mr. Gehring, I know this is on the fly, but do you have a recommendation about how we might accomplish that?
Right. So, Mr. Chair and members, I think the way to delete the title would be to propose an oral amendment that would be start on page 1, line 4, you'd strike directing the Secretary of State, and then line 1.5, strike to adopt rules, semicolon.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. I will move the oral amendment that on line 1.4, delete the words directing the Secretary of State, and on line 1.5, delete the words to adopt rules, semicolon. All in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Representative Lane, to your bill is amended.
Just a final comment that I agree with Representative Sanders. The study that we did, the small pilot study we did, I think was rushed and a little bit, we had some people that needed to move quickly to get something done, and it did not give us the time to do the considered project that we really wanted to. So now we shall do that and take your advice. So I renew my motion that House File 2166 be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee.
Thank you. Before we vote, I just want to say thank you, not only to Representative Lane, but to Representative O'Driscoll, who's not here. I know that this group, this working group, the study group, worked very hard in the interim. I popped in on some of the proceedings. I just sat and watched, and they were very diligent. All the members, not just the legislative members, but others as well, some of whom testified here today. So I just want to thank them for their work. It was kind of unheralded, unseen work by a lot of people, but they really did put their shoulders to the wheel over the interim, and I really appreciate the outcome. So with that, we'll vote on the bill. Representative Lane has just renewed her motion. So all in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Before we adjourn, I'll entertain Representative Bernardi's motion on approval of the minutes from our meeting on February 27th. She moves approval of the minutes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Members, as you can see, we still have two bills left that we didn't get to that are on the agenda. Those will be posted for the agenda on Thursday. And we reserve the right to add a bill or two. Not sure yet. But thanks, members, for your time and attention. The meeting's adjourned.